Our next speaker is Dr. Kathleen Pantillo. Dr. Pantillo is from the University of California, San Francisco, and her presentation will be on symptoms in dying ICU patients. Dr. Pantillo.
Session three. Session one, yes. Good morning, everyone. I want to start by saying how incredibly honored I am to have been asked to present preliminary findings from a study on symptoms in dying ICU patients. I want to provide the context for this work in showing you an intensive care unit, which is a setting for the treatment of critically ill and injured patients through the use of high technology, but more importantly, the skilled professionals who work in a multidisciplinary manner. It's important, this work is important, and this place is important for the cure of many patients, but unfortunately, the mortality rates for ICUs are high. If one considers all adult patients in ICUs, the mortality rate is from about 15 to 20%. But if the patient has cancer, that rate increases to greater than 40%. If they're mechanically ventilated, that rate goes up to 75%. And if a patient has had a bone marrow transplant and is now in multisystem failure, the mortality rate is almost 100%. Indeed, almost one in five Americans currently die while receiving ICU care. And so it's extremely important as we consider the cure that we consider and emphasize comfort for the dying. With that said, a question could be asked, what is the current science about symptom research in ICU patients? There has been years of research that has informed us that pain is a significant and prevalent symptom for ICU patients. And in fact, many methods of assessing pain in both verbal and nonverbal patients have been developed for use of many types of pain, including procedural pain, which is ubiquitous. Other research has explored to a limited degree several other symptoms, such as dyspnea, anxiety, fear, difficulty sleeping, thirst, and worry about hunger and general discomfort. And yet, if you look at that body of research, very few of the studies are, most of the studies are retrospective reviews, descriptive studies, and none of these studies focused on patients who were at high risk of dying who were dying in ICUs. A notable exception is the support study, which is a study that is probably familiar to most of those of you in the audience, in which there were over 3,000 interviews of dying patients or their family members, and 50% of them reported to be in pain. 15% of these patients had extremely severe pain at any frequency or moderately severe pain at least half of the time in their last days, and 15% were very dissatisfied with their pain control. And so, as a result of this prior research and attention to end-of-life care, there became a new scientific focus on symptom research in critically ill patients at high risk of dying. The first study that has documented the symptom experiences of ICU patients was conducted by Dr. Judy Nelson at Mount Sinai in New York. She enrolled patients who had a current or a past cancer diagnosis who were in ICUs and used a modified Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale. She enrolled 100 patients in her study, and yet only 50% were able to report their symptoms to her. The average age of her patient sample was 63, most were male, and most were being mechanically ventilated at the time. And she did find several symptoms that were rated by patients to be at the moderate to severe level. For example, over 75% of the patients in her study said that they were moderately or severely uncomfortable, while many also reported thirst, difficulty sleeping, anxiety, pain, hunger, depression, and dyspnea. What we found from this and previous studies was, first of all, that some ICU patients can participate in symptom assessments, that symptoms are prevalent and many of them are intense, and there is a high symptom burden for patients in ICUs. The limitation, however, of doing such work is that the vast majority of ICU patients have communication barriers. And so we can ask the question, can surrogates provide us valid information about patient symptoms? The patient's nurse, a family member, the patient's physician. Now, what do we know about surrogate reports? Well, there are certain factors we know that can increase the surrogate's levels of accuracy. For example, there's a 74% accuracy rate in estimating the presence or the absence of a symptom. And the accuracy rate is high, indeed, when patients' levels of pain are at the lowest and highest extremes. In addition, surrogates are able to accurately estimate within one level of the patient's pain. Furthermore, surrogates are accurate if they're being interviewed on the same day as patient interviews, an intervention that is not followed in many of these surrogate studies. Surrogates can be accurate for symptoms rated by the patients as being the most distressing. And finally, for symptoms with more observable signs, such as pain, cough, or fatigue. This work led to the development of a pilot study on surrogate reports of ICU patient symptoms, and I was pleased to have been funded by Soros Project on Death in America for this study. What we wanted to do was to describe the assessment and management of distressing symptoms in ICU patients who are at high risk of dying from the perspectives of four respondents, the patients whenever possible, a family member, the patient's nurse, and physician. I'm going to concentrate primarily on some of the data that were obtained between the patients and families. We had 24 patients in the study whose mean age was 58, and their mean Apache 2 score was 24. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Apache 2 scores, it's a measure of acuity of illness that ranges from 0 to 71, but is highly skewed to the left. Not many people with Apache scores of 40 survive. They had multiple diagnoses, and the hospital mortality rate was 42%. Of the 24 patients in the study, only 13 were able to report their symptoms. And these are the symptoms they reported. If you look at this slide, what is being focused upon is symptom intensity using a scale of none, mild, moderate, and severe, with the patient's reports on the left side and the family reports on the right. You will notice a few symptoms that are very intense for some of the patients, including thirst, hunger, and pain. Now, when we look at the concordance between the patients and the family reports, we see that there is a close concordance for some of these symptoms, specifically tired, restlessness, anxiety, and sadness. We also examined the distress that was associated with the symptoms from the perspectives of the patients and family members, and again found some lack of concordance with some of the symptoms, but close concordance with others. For example, pain, tired or fatigue, restlessness, and hunger. With this information, it developed a study on a larger scale to assess and treat symptoms of ICU patients across a number of days. And I'm very grateful to NINR for the funding of this study. What we are doing is enrolling at-risk patients, and we're defining patients to be at risk if they've been in the intensive care units 3 days or longer, and if their Apache scores are 20 or greater. We're interviewing up to four respondents, the patient, family, nurse, and physician, and collecting a lot of data related to factors that could influence the symptom reports in the areas of illness, treatments, and the environment. I will not be reporting on any of those data. As of 4 months of data collection, so you see that we're very early into the study, we've enrolled 25 patient groups, an average age of 62, most are female, most are white, and their Apache scores average 31, which compared to the pilot study shows that this is a sicker patient sample. Their duration in the ICU averages 16 days. They have many diagnoses, including respiratory failure, chronic liver disease, MODS, any system failure plus a malignancy, cardiac failure, and many of them have more than one of these diagnoses. Now, what I'm reporting here is, although we're going to use linear mixed effects modeling when we look at concordance across respondents and across ICU days, we are following patients up to 14 days and interviewing these respondents, these groups, every other day. But for the purposes of today's presentations, I'm simply showing frequencies related to the one question that we ask the respondents: is this particular symptom present, yes or no, even though we are gaining information about the symptom intensity, frequency, and distress. Now, this is a very busy slide, and I have a very short period of time. So the first thing that I would like to draw your attention to is to the left-hand column, to note the symptoms that we are assessing to be pain, dyspnea, restlessness, anxiety, and sadness. Also hunger, being scared, thirsty, tired, or confused. Now I'm going back to the first symptom assessment or findings slide to emphasize a few points related to some of this reporting that we've obtained. The first symptom that I'd like us to draw our attention to is that of pain. Only one-third of the patients reported being in pain, and yet the other respondents felt that the patients were in considerably more pain, or more frequent, more of the respondents noted that the patient was in more pain than did the patient himself or herself. And I'm wondering if because of the attention that has been drawn to pain assessment and pain management, we're doing a better job for the patients that may not be observed by other respondents. I'd next like to draw your attention to the two symptoms of restlessness and anxiety. Again, only one-third of the patients reported these symptoms to be present, while the others noted, other respondents noted them to be present more frequently. And there is quite a difference, if you look at the symptom of anxiety, between the patient's report and the nurse's and the physician's reports. I wonder what type of behaviors are being observed by these health professionals that make them feel that more patients are restless or anxious than the patients feel. Now, hunger. If we look at the symptom of hunger, which is a symptom that receives almost no attention in critical care settings, we see that there is a strong concordance among all of the respondents when asked if the patient is hungry. Now, about confusion, I'd like to make two points related to the symptom. First of all, it's noteworthy, I believe, that 42% of the patients could recognize in themselves that they were confused. And secondly, that the concordance of reports around confusion are very similar among the patients, the family members, and the nurses, but not as close with the physicians. Finally, I want to emphasize two other symptoms, that of thirst and of being tired. First, tired. 83% of the patients in an ICU that have been interviewed have reported being tired. That is not too surprising considering the environment of an intensive care unit. When we looked at the responses of other people, they were in quite a high degree of concordance with the patients about the patient being tired. But if you look at the symptom of thirst, we see that 82% of the patients report being thirsty. And this report comes from study after study, albeit limited numbers of studies, that patients are extremely thirsty, and most of the patients have this symptom. But if we look at the other respondents, we see a decrease in the number of respondents, particularly of physicians who consider patients to be thirsty. I think what this says is that we must continue to attend to not just the physical symptoms that can be observed, but other symptoms that may be present in many of our patients in critical care settings. So what are the goals of this current research? Well, first of all, the goal is to develop a comprehensive description of ICU patients' symptoms and to determine if there are surrogates, families, nurses, physicians, who can report accurately the symptoms that are experienced by ICU patients. A certain surrogate may be more informative about certain symptoms than another one. All of this is to develop the data to be able to develop and test appropriate symptom interventions for ICU patients who are at high risk of dying. I thank you for your attention.